Good evening, everyone. You're all very welcome. I hope that the voice travels okay. Sometimes people think a microphone should be used, but I think the room is small enough for people to wave if there is a gap in communication at any stage. Please do. This is a joint meeting of the Royal College of General Practitioners and of the Ulster Medical Society, and we're delighted to see good representation from both societies here. We're also delighted to welcome Professor Helen Lester, who has come across the water today. She's a busy person. She is an actively practicing general practitioner in Birmingham. She is Professor of General Practice and Primary Care in Manchester, and she is the chair of the new Clinical Innovation and Research Centre in the Royal College of General Practitioners. So she has many strings to her bow. And she's going to talk to us tonight about quality and practice. Just before she does, I have a couple of announcements to make. One is, we'd be delighted to see as many people as possible at the Ulster Medical Society dinner next Friday. John Craig is here tonight, and you could avoid the cost of a postage stamp if you actually filled in a form and gave it to him before you left. We're also grateful to Tim Lowry and Kevin Lowry for sponsoring the meeting for tonight, but that's the only way in which GSK have contributed to the meeting. So in case any of you do wish to know that, we have an agenda, which I'm not sure you've actually on board with you, but you could take this back with you. At the end of the meeting, if you would like to take one pass around, at the end of the meeting, there is a certificate of attendance for everyone who has taken part, and John has those in his custody just at the moment, so they're not for distribution just yet. And lastly, just as Helen's starting to speak, if I could ask, if you wouldn't mind, please, just signing your name on the attendance register for this evening, we'd be very grateful, and the pen going on with it. Guys, welcome. Yes. So without further ado, could I say welcome to Helen, and the stage is yours. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me. Margaret invited me quite a few months ago and suggested that I should talk to this topic. It's one of those things that you say in the summer, yes, that'll be lovely, and then suddenly you realise it's Christmas, and then you realise that January is around the corner. So this is a new talk with my new hat, if you like, as chair of CERC. So I hope it goes all right. What I'm going to talk to you about over the next 30-40 minutes is I'm going to talk about some interesting innovations, at least I think they're interesting innovations, from the States and from the United Kingdom. Because the one thing I think we're never short of as medics is good ideas. So when I looked on Google, that well-known scholarly database, and put innovations in, I got back hundreds and hundreds of hits. And I thought, well, this will be interesting. I wonder what other people think innovations mean. And of course, an innovation, what you think about it depends on who you are and where you practice and also sort of what time you practice. So for example, the Royal Society of Medicine had an innovation summit last year, and they talked about things like tracheal transplants in children and artificial pancreases. And I thought, this is all fascinating, but I can hardly come along to Belfast and talk to you about tracheal transplantation, even though, you know, academically, it's rather wonderful. And then the Harvard Business Review last year had a top 10 list of innovations, and that was things like robots in surgery and the Human Genome Project. But there were some interesting things on there as well, I think interesting for us, like the checklist project, which I am going to talk to you a little bit about, and evidence-based medicine and pay for performance. And then just bringing it a bit closer, I think, to us in primary care at least, the Health Services Management Centre in Birmingham produced a report last year all about innovations in primary care. And that was about different ways of working. So that was about segmentation, defragmentation, about changing people's roles and responsibilities. So I'm going to talk a little bit about those sorts of things. And then what I want to do is try and bring them together so that you can see some of the commonalities behind these innovations, try and bring it a bit more down to sort of the stuff that we do in everyday practice. And then I'm going to talk a little bit, because this is a joint meeting with the college, about some of the things that the college is doing at the moment that I hope you're going to be interested in terms of innovations. And finally, in an attempt to try and bring this all together, I'm going to fly a kite with you all about the notion of scholarship in primary care. And that this road, this is how my husband describes, well, me sometimes actually, and certainly the way I write and often the way I talk, which is, you know, you sort of know where she's going, and it sort of wanders around a bit, and you have to sort of keep the faith that I'll get there in the end. and I hope it's reasonably attractive as and interesting as we go. So that's a sort of metaphor for the way I am, I'm afraid. So let's start with some of these Harvard Business Review innovations. Now, this is a WHO checklist. Now, there are 230 million operations each year. That is one operation for every 25 human beings. I mean, a huge number of operations. Each year, 7 million people worldwide have some sort of surgical complication. And 1 million people die as a result of a surgical complication. These are all figures from the WHO. Now, if you sort of took that from a public health perspective, and you had something that had a morbidity rate, or a morbidity number of 7 million, and deaths of 1 million, that's actually, well, it's not quite as bad as TB and malaria, but, you know, you're wandering along the road towards that end of the spectrum anyway. So in 2004, the WHO thought there's got to be better ways of thinking about how we look at morbidity and mortality in surgery. So they devised a 19-item checklist, and it was piloted in 8 hospitals around the world. And you may well have seen the results. These were sort of rapidly published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2009. And what they found is that the 30-day inpatient mortality rate across these 8 hospitals in different parts of the world dropped from 1.5% to 0.8%, which was statistically significant to a vast number of zeros. And as a result of that, this checklist is beginning to rapidly filter through the hospital system. So back in 2009, there were hundreds of hospitals using it. There are now thousands of hospitals using this across the world. So in terms of rapid dissemination, this is really rapidly filtering through, including my own local DGH. I've had patients reporting that they've come back and they've been asked questions time and time again and wanting to know, why was I asked 3 times? And I go, well, actually, this is actually good medicine. It's not bad medicine. Now, the thing I think is really interesting about this checklist is not that you ask, what, you know, is the site marked and is the patient consented and is there enough blood from the blood bank? You know, it's all very important. The bit that I think is really, really interesting is these questions here. Confirm all team members have introduced themselves by name and by role. And this is, I think, the bit where the message comes in for us in primary care. If you think about surgeons, they perform in a theatre, you know. Certainly when I was a surgical houseman and a SHO, it was about the surgeon as the prima donna in the middle of this operating theatre. Now, this is a long time ago, and things have changed, but they have not changed, I think, that much. So that I think the real innovation here is at the beginning of every operation, this checklist says that you introduce yourself by your first name. So I would say, hello, I'm not the surgeon, but, you know, the equivalent would be, hello, I'm Helen Lester, and I'm a GP, and my role today is. And everybody in the theatre talks like that. So it really engenders a feeling of teamwork that apparently translates into better teamwork in practice. And I was thinking about that in the context of my own practice and thinking, well, actually, we think we have great teamwork, but there are still some of my staff who call me Dr. Lester rather than Helen. It's not absolutely uniform. My patients at Christmas gave me presents. They didn't give the girls on the reception all presents. There are still things where, even if you think you work in a completely flat structure, you may not work in quite a flat structure as you initially think. I thought it was just interesting to reflect on. So an innovation that you think is all about surgery, but maybe has lessons for us in primary care as well. One of the other things in the Harvard Business Review was evidence-based medicine. Now, I talked about things that rapidly disseminate, like this surgical checklist. Well, you're all going to know, I'm sure you all know, David Sackett's BMJ editorial 15 years ago. Wonderful, concise description of what evidence-based medicine is. But evidence-based medicine has been around for centuries. If you don't know this story, it's worth knowing, and if you do know it, it may be worth retelling. So bear with me on this one. So James Lind was a naval surgeon on HMS Salisbury. And although we'd known from Drake's time that if you gave sailors lime juice, and that would prevent scurvy, it had never actually got implemented. So what he did, and I love this, he got 12 sailors who were all showing early signs of scurvy. And he divided them up into pairs, and he gave them each a quart of cider, unspecified elixir, heaven knows what that was, seawater, garlic, mustard and horseradish, a spoonful of vinegar, or two oranges and a lemon. Now, he only had 6 days' worth, apparently, of the oranges and lemons, so if you were in that little pair, you got 6 days' worth of treatment. If you're in one of the other five little pairs, you had 14 days. This is a proper randomised trial back in 1747. It was a 14-day trial length. I think he split his alpha because he had two primary outcomes. He had gum disease and he also had skin conditions. But at the end of the 14 days, what he found was that nobody changed very much, apart from the people on side who felt better, I suspect. And those who had two oranges and a lemon had a dramatic recovery. However, it took 7 years before James Lind was allowed, apparently, to talk about it, because the Admiralty didn't really like it. It didn't really fit with their prevailing notion of how you should prevent scurvy. And it took 50 years before the Admiralty actually introduced lemons as part of the rations of sailors. So yeah, evidence-based medicine, there is no such thing as a new idea under the sun. It had been around for at least 200 years before Sackett got terribly famous, telling us all how to do it. Now, I should say, some of the examples that I've chosen are things that I've been involved with in my academic life. That sounds like I'm being terribly arrogant. It's not meant to be. It just means I know where the bodies are buried, so I can sort of talk about them if there are questions afterwards, if you like. So I have, for better or for worse, an association with the Quality and Outcomes Framework since 2005, where I've been one of the academic advisors about it. So there was Pay for Performance. Payment Innovations was there, and the Harvard Business Review of top 10 innovations. And as we all know, there are very many ways to pay doctors, none of them exactly right. QoF was introduced in 2004. Nobody ever worked out whether or not it's a quality improvement mechanism or whether or not it's a payment mechanism. Nobody has still worked out what it is, and that is part of the problem that we've now run into with QoF. But certainly in 2004, Paul Schakelly, who was medical director at RAND, wrote an editorial in the BMJ where he said, this is an initiative to improve the quality of primary care that is the boldest such proposal on this scale ever attempted in the world, with one mighty leap. The NHS has vaulted over anything being attempted in the United States, the previous leader in quality improvement initiatives. So everybody thought it was a terribly good innovation. However, we have reached a point now where QoF is completely out of kilter with the rest of the world in terms of pay for performance. These are sort of comparative stats from the States. In the States, although P4P is very prevalent, on average there are five performance measures in each of their little P4P systems. We have 134 in ours. It's 5 to 7% of physician pay in the States. It's 20 to 25% of ours. Now there is there's a paper coming out in the BMJ tomorrow that I've had to write a college defence of. So, anyway, it's a paper about QoF, and a group from Harvard and from Nottingham have had a look through using the Thin database at the effect of QoF on hypertension measurement, hypertension control. Sorry.
Sorry, this is a joint meeting. I'm not sure what QoF
means. Oh, I'm really sorry. Quality and Outcomes Framework, and please do stop me if I say things that are bad like that. Sorry. Paper Performance Scheme in Primary Care. So this paper is coming out, and what it is saying, and it's beautifully done, it's not a statistical error, beautifully done, is that QoF has made no difference whatsoever to blood pressure measurement, blood pressure control, or longer-term cardiovascular outcomes. And they have data from 2004 onwards. And this country has spent millions of pounds on QoF hypertension. It's spent billions altogether. QoF costs £1 billion a year. But it has spent millions of pounds on hypertension. So I'm going to tell you another story. I'm going to tell you the story of this ship, which is the Thomas W. Lawson. Now, This ship was, do you make ships? You build ships. This ship was built in 1902. This ship was built because people were worried that steamships were coming in, and steamships were beginning to get all the work in terms of freight carriage, particularly from the States over to Europe. So the people who made these sorts of sail ships thought, bigger has got to be better. Rather than thinking, oh, steamships have come along, that's a completely new sort of technology, I wonder if we should rethink the things that we're doing. They went, hang on a sec, if 5 masts is good, 7 masts must be absolutely fabulous. So they built this ship with 7 masts in 1902. And this ship couldn't fit in most of the ports in Europe. And this ship, on about its 5th voyage from Philadelphia over to the United Kingdom, sank just off the Scilly Isles in 1907 because there was a really bad storm that the steamships were all fine in. But this ship had got so many sails that it went down. It went down with a loss of all bar 2 lives. And the moral for me is that Quaff might have been a fantastic innovation in 2004, but what's now happened is that people think, oh my goodness me, other things are coming on online. Primary care is changing, but we do have this thing called Quaff. What we must do is we must add more to it. We just must make it bigger, but bigger is not necessarily better. So I suppose the moral is beware the innovation you wish for. So I'm going to try and bring it a bit closer to home. Those are the things that were, you know, the Americans said were all fantastic innovations. I'm going to tell you a story about one of my patients, a little old lady who's 90, a very independent lady, never married, was a school teacher, much loved, but is now 90 and is getting frailer, and looked after as well as she possibly can be by her neighbours. And I had that sort of dreaded 28th of December call. It was with Christmas this year, you know, we were off for, well, certainly in England, we were off for quite a lot of time, so it was really busy, 27th, 28th, 29th, which is a really bad day. Anyhow, I had a call. And she'd fallen the previous night, and the paramedics had got called out, and she hadn't broken her leg. So her neighbours had got her upstairs, that I swear looked like this. I mean, this isn't her house for obvious reasons, but when I was Googling for stairs, I just put in very steep stairs. I love Google. This picture came up. I thought, that'll do. That's exactly what it felt like. I love these boots. I had these boots on, and I was sort of climbing up the stairs, thinking, you know, I've got hands on both sides, thinking, I'm going to fall, I know. So heaven knows how a 90-year-old lady manages those stairs, and the answer is, she doesn't really very well. So her neighbours had got her into bed. Fiercely independent lady, actually fit as a fiddle in very many ways, but now couldn't get downstairs, couldn't get herself out to the toilet, couldn't make herself a cup of tea. You're going to know this picture. You will all have had these sorts of pictures. And I'm there, and I walk through the door. You know that thing where relatives always sort of go, and they take you into the other room before you're allowed to see the patient, and you think, oh, it's going to be a long one. And they, you know, and I'm in there, and I'm sitting down with my bag, and I'm thinking, I've got enough 5 visits before you. Anyway, and they were just explaining how difficult it was. They could no longer care for her. You know, they were at the end of their tether, and that they were not relatives; they were neighbours. And I went upstairs, and one of these neighbours said to me, "Well, can't you admit her? Last time she was like this, Doctor XYZ admitted her." And I was thinking, well, I can't admit her. You know, there's actually nothing medically, surgically wrong with her. Anyway, so a long preamble. What we now have, and I don't know if you have this in Belfast, but we certainly have it in Birmingham, have a fantastic intermediate care service. So I was able to get back to the ranch, pick up the phone, speak to a real person, explain the situation, and the social worker went out about 2 hours later, and respite care was found for her the following day, but the neighbours knew that, and they were quite happy to do another overnight shift. And she went into respite care for a couple of weeks. And during that time, she's begun to think about whether or not she can stay by herself, living by herself any longer. And whether or not she needs to go into some form of residential care, and she's gone back to her own house actually at the minute, but it's begun to make her think whether or not she should lose an element of her independence. But what that simple phone call, what that intermediate care service has done is saved an admission, kept her dignity, given her chance to think about what she wants to do. These are the sort of innovations in care that I think are really important. They make a huge difference to our patients' lives. And this is going to be my last example before I move on to college stuff. And I use this example because I've been quite involved with primary care mental health workers. Now, what I should have checked with Margaret and didn't, do you have primary care mental health workers? And good, I'm seeing some nods, thank goodness for that. Phew. Right, so mental health workers, they were announced in the NHS plan a long time ago now, in 2000, and we were supposed to have 1,000 of them by 2004. We didn't, but we were supposed to have 1,000 of them. And they were devised for a number of reasons. One of those is that 30% of our consultations in primary care have some sort of mental health element to it. And remember, this was 2000 that the plan came out, long before NICE guidance came out, long before we had notions of stepped care, long before improving access to psychological therapies came along. This is when we really did have ourselves, maybe a counsellor if you were really lucky, and probably an SSRI available to treat people with depression. I mean, there may have been some other things, and I'm paraphrasing not terribly well here, but there wasn't the range of workers that you could refer to back 10, 11 years ago. I was also a glut of psychology graduates. Let's be really pragmatic here. There was a huge class of psychology graduates, and the government couldn't put them all through to clinical psychology courses. They just simply weren't the places. So one of the great wheezes that came up was, let's have these primary care graduate mental health workers. So what happened was that there was a huge rush, and it was done very well, fantastic leadership here. There was a huge rush to get 19 universities to provide the courses to train these graduate workers. There was lots of leadership at a local level to find the money to employ these graduates. My little team were given some money to do a trial and also to do some qualitative work to see about the value of primary care mental health workers, and we found that they were the glue in the system. Patients love them, describe them as the glue between primary care and sometimes secondary care, or the glue between primary care and the voluntary sector. They had a great role in befriending, just being with somebody. Listening and being with is very important. And our trial found a significant increase in patient satisfaction with their care if they'd seen a primary care mental health worker. But in terms of implementation of innovations, the things that we found were really, really difficult. But interestingly, around different cultures within the health service, finding it difficult to accept a new worker. So counsellors felt terribly threatened by these workers, even though most of them were sort of 21-year-old lovely young women, and they were largely women, actually, particularly the first cohort. So counsellors felt very threatened. CPNs felt terribly threatened by them. You know, do they want my job? I had a terrible experience, actually, coming back to me now. Terrible experience. I had to go and talk to the annual meeting of British councillors down in London, and I wasn't quite booed off the stage, but it was pretty close to it, because I was extolling the virtues of graduate workers, and they were all feeling terribly threatened by them. And there was also a problem in practices. Practices wanted to know, we had one practice manager who said, yes, but who pays for the photocopying? And another one said, yes, but, you know, just in terms of the paper that they're using to write, who pays for the paper? So it wasn't, you know, the big getting the university courses right or the courses were funding them. It was a little bit. It was about getting those cultural things right. And once we clicked that the barriers to implementing this innovation were reassuring counsellors, reassuring CPNs, talking to the practice managers, talking to the PCNs about the little things, and then these workers started to flow through the system. And you know, there are now about 1,500 primary care mental health workers. Not a lot, but, you know, they're there, and I think they are part of the furniture now. So what do you need to make an innovation stick? I think you need a clear vision of where you're going. I think you have a checklist. Really clear vision of what they wanted to do. You need effective leadership. A lot of the things I've talked about have had really effective leadership. You need really good teamwork. Staff need to understand their roles and responsibilities. They need to feel really supported in that. I was just saying with the primary care mental health workers, cultures, you've got to get it right culturally. And it needs to make sense on the ground. It needs to make a difference to patients. I am now an absolute advocate for intermediate care. in a way that I wasn't before that visit at the end of December. Needs to make things a little bit better. So I'm going to talk about, because this is the college, I'm going to talk about some of the college innovations. I'm not going to talk about the Centre for Commissioning, because I realise that it's just, there's no point in talking, well, there probably would be a point, if only to tell you how terrible it all is at the moment. But I'm not going to talk about Centre for Commissioning. I'm going to talk about some of the initiatives in training, some of the initiatives around clinical champions, and a little bit about some of the initiatives and the innovations around research that the college is currently involved with. So let me tell you a little bit about education and training. As we all know, 3 years training at the moment, you know, for the most complex, the most difficult job in the health service, the 3 years training, which is just ridiculous. Medical Education England threw out the notion of 5 year training about a year ago, but Andrew Lansley has encouraged a new submission of about 5 year training, which I think is really very encouraging. And is particularly encouraging us to ensure that paediatrics and mental health training have a prominent part in any resubmission about training. And I think, actually, in terms of a great innovation for us as a profession, I think if we could get five-year training, it would make a huge difference on all sorts of different levels, including that status thing. I remember my first day at medical school in Cardiff in 1980. I didn't come from a medical family. I was the first person in my family to go to uni. And I remember the surgeon standing in front of us and saying, half of you, I'm afraid, will end up as general practitioners. And I went, oh, because everybody else went, oh, I had no idea why I thought that, you know, I just went along with the herd. A terrible thing to be a general practitioner. I think five-year training will be a fantastic thing on all sorts of different levels for our patients, for the health service in terms of probably saving money in the longer term, as long as we remember to look 10 years down the road, not 2.5 years down the road. And good for us. I think ours feel better. E-learning for general practice, if you've not discovered it, is well worth a look. It won a silver award at the E-learning Health Awards about 3 months ago, and it covers the whole of the GP curriculum. Made for the GP registrars, but frankly, I find it really useful. So it's great. If you've not seen it, there's Essential Knowledge Update, which is made for us, but actually do take a look at e-learning for general practice. You'll find, I hope you'll find, a really helpful way of thinking about your CPD needs. First five is something that probably none of us had. I can't see anybody quite young enough to be part of first five. Yeah, I'm certainly far too old. First five is an initiative in the college to take people from that moment when they qualify. You know, that scary feeling, your first day in surgery. You know, you're the new GP. It's a bit like when you first passed your driving test, you know, the first time you're actually in the car all by yourself, and that sort of sense of fear that you didn't have when somebody else was by the side of you. That feeling again for new GPs. So there is a five-year support group, basically. They've got a fantastic Facebook, and they all use Twitter and all sorts of things that I don't really understand. But there's a great support network for GPs as they go through their first 5 years. And it's first five that takes them up to their first revalidation. So again, if you know anybody who's at that stage in their career, it is well worth signposting them towards this teaching innovation. And finally, the college, you know, can be a bit GP-centric, but then it is the Royal College of General Practitioners, so I think we can be forgiven for that. But there's a General Practice Foundation now, been there for a couple of years. It's only got a couple of hundred people who've signed up, but it's very much made for practice managers, practice nurses, and physician's assistants. So, again, if you are interested, it's well worth again looking on the college website, because there is a group there, a newly forming group there, to support practice managers and practice nurses. A little bit about clinical champions. Matt Houghton is our clinical champion for learning disabilities. We have 12 clinical champions at the moment, covering a disparate range of subjects. We are just about to interview for 4 more in social exclusion, nutrition for health, which is just another way of saying obesity, domestic violence, and chronic pain. So we are soon going to have 16 clinical champions. But I just want to tell you a little bit about the work that Matt Houghton has done. He has produced some fantastic guidance around caring for people for learning disabilities. People with learning disabilities are 53 times more likely to die before they should than the general population. They have the same consultation rates as people without a learning disability. So it's not the physical act that they have a problem with, but it's the fact that we have 10 minutes and it can be very difficult to communicate with people with a learning disability, and we're not very good at it, frankly. So
symptoms of health promotion, health education, illnesses that can be picked up early. People with learning disability have much higher morbidity and much higher mortality rates than the general population. But there is also very good evidence that if you look, you find, and if you find, you can make things better. And what Matt has done is produce some fantastic guidance based on the Cardiff Health Check that takes you through as a practice how to give a really good annual learning disability check from sign language and cards that you can use, from copies of letters that you can send out that make sense to somebody whose IQ is perhaps 70. And the reason I know that this innovation is going to be implemented is that my wonderful, wonderful husband, truly wonderful, wonderful husband, came home about 2 months ago, and he plunked this thing down on the kitchen table, and he said, "This is the sort of thing that you should be involved with in the college." And I went, "Sir, RCGP, thank you very much." Ordinary, cold-faced, proper doctors, like my other half, have picked it up and thought, this is really going to help me in practice, and that is going to change, little by little, the care that our really needy group receive. Research ready. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about research because it's sort of my background. At the moment, there's only 450 practices who have taken part in Research Ready, but hurrah, at last, with Margaret's help, it is now available right across the United Kingdom. So you can, if you want to, go online and you can go through these five core modules online. And at the end of it, you will be ready to do some research in terms of understanding good clinical practice, understanding the latest guidance on trial management, on ethics, on research governance. It takes about half a day, to be honest. Most practices ask their practice manager, or if they have a senior practice nurse who's very involved in research, to do it. We have evidence from the 450 practices who've already been involved in Research Ready that it really does increase their confidence in terms of taking part in research. So 72% of them said that they were involved in research before they did Research Ready, and 92% after this little bit of training are getting involved in research. And actually, while I'm banging the drum about research, something like 3,900 practices across the United Kingdom are now involved in some sort of research, which actually was quite a surprising figure to me when I finally got it out of the Primary Care Research Network. And something like 30% of all patients who have been recruited in the research networks, all of the clinical research networks, are recruited from primary care. Trouble is, I slightly worry that primary care has been the handmaiden here, that we are the site that sucks up patients into other people's trials. And I think it is incredibly important that schemes like Research Ready and other schemes empower frontline general practitioners to take their really good ideas and turn them into research projects. And I'm going to give you just a few examples of where people have done that with academic support, but nevertheless have been able to do that. These are the RCGP Research Papers of the Year for the last 5 years. So we've got Willie Hamilton in Bristol, who produced this lovely paper in the BMJ last year that showed that ovarian cancer is not the silent killer, that women do present often months before the diagnosis is made with abdominal distension, with urinary frequency, and with abdominal pain. Now, this is a cohort study. It's probably associative rather than causal because of the methodology, but certainly pretty good evidence that actually if a woman under 50 comes in with those symptoms, there's a 1 in 40 chance that she's going to have ovarian cancer, well worth thinking about an ultrasound scan. We know from Frank Sullivan's fantastic trial, Frank Sullivan is a GP in Dundee, that actually you treat Bell's palsy with prednisolone. Acyclovir has no place in the treatment of Bell's palsy. Now, what an important question, you know? What else have we got? Oh, the Oxford studies, both of these came from the Department of Primary Care in Oxford, but again, they involve frontline general practitioners. If a school-aged kid comes in and has been coughing for 2 weeks, even if they've been immunised, think who can cough, was the bottom line of that study. Really important, really clinically interesting question. This study by Anthony Harnden, frontline GP in Oxford, basically said there is no point in giving little ones with acute conjunctivitis chloramphenicol. Makes no difference whatsoever to the outcomes. You know, waste of time. Trish Greenhouse, lovely study looking at lung age. If you tell patients what their lung age is, they are statistically significantly more likely to give up smoking. Now, I put these up because I think they are fantastic examples of frontline driven questions. Nothing to do with pharma. Nothing to do, I mean, some of them were trials. But really important questions. I've rather cheekily put that one on because that's my paper back in 2005. And actually, I put it on because I did it on a song. It cost me £5,000, that study. We ran 18 focus groups with people with serious mental illness and general practitioners, and we got them talking to each other face-to-face about what their care could be like. And what we heard at the end of it was people with schizophrenia telling us actually primary care is the cornerstone of our care, even though traditionally general practitioners have said, nothing to do with me, mate. People with the illness said, oh, yes, it is. SFB, we have funded 140 projects since 1995. Tom Fahey in Dublin, Chris Butler in Wales, Camish in Leicester, Roger Gadsby in Warwick, Paul Little in Southampton, Carl Hennigan in Oxford. These people, when they were really junior, when they were really starting out, back in the mid-1990s, they applied for little tiny grants of £10,000 from the SFB. And on the whole, their first or their second paper was something very small, very pragmatic, funded by the SFB. So if you're looking for seed corn funding for ideas that you just want to test out, think about the SFB. So time is running on, and I've told you lots, I hope, about innovation. But this is the bit where I want to fly a kite with you about scholarship. So I've talked about everyday innovations. And I was thinking, well, how do we get everyday innovations into practice? What would that actually mean? If I'm trying to teach medical students, or I'm talking to associates in training, or first five, and then I thought, well, maybe it's about having a scholarly attitude to everything we do. Maybe it's about being scholarly when we're in front of our patients, when we're talking to our staff, when we're doing our audits, when we are training the medical students. And then I thought, well, let's find a decent definition of scholarship then. And this is Ernest Boyer's definition of scholarship. Ernest Boyer was a US Commissioner of Education back in the 70s and 80s. And he worked at Harvard for a while, and he came up with this sort of four-segmented definition of scholarship, which I think really rings true. It's about the scholarship of discovery, of original research. It's about the scholarship of integration, which is translational research, really, sort of stuff that we do. It's the research papers of the year. The scholarship of application, so what we do in practice. And then finally, it's about the scholarship of teaching. So that's about communicating effectively with your partners, but also with your medical students and with your trainees. And I thought, yeah, that's actually something that has a sort of intrinsic sense to it. So I'm going to finish with yet another story. That's a true story. You know, New Year's Day, and you think, must clean something. Well, I think, must clean something. So I thought, right, I'll clean out the garage. And I've got boxes, box files everywhere. And I got bored of cleaning, so I thought I'd open up my box files and see what was in them. And so this is seriously a true story. And I opened up this one box file. It had 1984 written on the side of it. And I used to learn, I'm afraid, by tearing articles out of journals. Not from the library, but tearing articles out of journals. And then felt tipping them. And I thought, I wonder what I thought was important in 1984. And they're all yellowy and smelt very fusty. And I found this article. I was a family and med student in 84, and this bloke that I kept mentioning, my husband, we just started going out. And that made me feel very old. And I found this, and I'd highlighted it when I was a final year. And I decided I did want to be a general practitioner by the final year. But I'd highlighted this from John Horder. John Horder is the past president of the college, and that's his painting, which is currently... apparently you can buy it and it helps the college new building fund. But anyway, John Hall, a beautiful painter, as well as a fantastic general practitioner and ex-president. So John Horder wrote, and I'm going to read it out because I think this is beautiful. So for me, there is no dividing line between academic and ordinary general practitioners. Indeed, the idea that any doctor could be merely a practical worker, responding to patient demands according to set habits of mind acquired long since, seems ridiculous. None of us can survive without some source of updating that challenges what we thought before and forces us to question it and to decide which is right. But some do it more often and more deeply than others. But he's saying that we can all be scholarly, that we can all be part of everyday innovations.
And I would suggest, if we can, that can only be good for our patients. So I will leave you with that thought. Thank you very much for coming and for listening.
Thank you very much, Helen. I'm looking forward to it. Professor Scott Brown, who is the chair of the Royal College. He's going to lead from here.
Thank you very much, Margaret. I've been extremely impressed with the surgical safety checklist, so I have to tell you that I am Scott. And I'm here to fend off the wall of questions which are going to come immediately rolling towards Helen Lester. Helen, thank you very much for a wonderfully stimulating 50 minutes. I had a look at my watch, as I used to do frequently when I was a student in this building. And I have to say, the first time I looked at my watch was almost at the end of the presentation. So that's a fairly useful barometer and how interested we all were. Open to the floor. I'm sure many of you have questions, not least perhaps some of our secondary care colleagues to have some of the abbreviations explained.
Oh yes, I am sorry about that.
Thanks for a great talk, Helen. I was interested what you were saying in much of your talk, but particularly what got me at the beginning was your remarks about hypertension and the quality of outcomes framework, and your assertion that you could not demonstrate any improvement in outcomes on the basis of QOF. I must say, my early impressions of QOF, once you got used to it, I had convinced myself that, certainly in diabetes, QOF concentrated the mind quite nicely and quite usefully on actually very important outcome measures and very important interventions. And I had convinced myself that, in fact, I was controlling my patients, or my patients' care was much improved through following through the QOF. I'll comment about how QOF has developed and the problems that we now face with QOF, but I would be interested in your comments on, is that right across the board? Do you think that the quality and outcomes framework is not making any difference to the quality of care we're giving our patients?
No,
and it's purely a payment system.
I don't think it's across the board. Actually, I don't. I think the problem with the hypertension, and I know the problem with the hypertension because we've got data on this at work, is that the achievement rates were very high pre-QOF. So if 90% of the general practitioners are already measuring blood pressure,
yes,
and getting blood pressure below 150-90, which is not that hard to do, you know, on the whole, 150-90, then there's nowhere to go.
Yeah.
I think on the more challenging indicators, and in diabetes there are some more challenging indicators, I think if anybody did look at that, they would find some changes. But I think some of QOF is just too simple, and we were doing it very well to begin with, and so I'm not remotely surprised when the BMJ sent me the paper and said you're going to get asked some questions, do you want to have a quick look, I read it and thought, yeah, I'm just not surprised. But the message is, you've got to start with things that we're not doing very well and incentivise that, not keep on adding more and more and more to it. I think you strip it out. This isn't about QOF, I think you strip it right out, to be honest. I think you take half of it out. You halve its size, and then what you put in are things where we know we aren't doing very well, where a 10% increase will have real meaning for many patients. That's what I think.
Of course, the other implication of QOF is that it has caused a very substantial change in the philosophy of general practice, because there are now more and more primary care asthmatic specialists, diabetic specialists, etc., etc. Usually within a given practice you find that one doctor takes a particular area, and the longer it goes on, the more expert he or she becomes, the more de-skilled the other partners become, unless there is a real attempt to continue educating those in practice, and very often there's not the time for that. And you try suggesting at a partner's meeting that doctors move around and somebody now does epilepsy and somebody does this, and produces a lot of blanching.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
Could I challenge you in your last point about hypertension? I don't feel that hypertension was particularly well treated or controlled in the United Kingdom prior to COVID. I think the statistics would show that maybe, I can't remember exactly, but what did I say, 10% in the UK were actually controlled, and you know, the vast majority were not controlled adequately at a level of 140 over 90. And the Americans used to say that the British didn't control hypertension at all. Mm. Just wonder what your...
I think the process measure of physically putting the cuff round, we do have very good evidence that that was way over 90% pre-COVID. The audit targets, actually most GPs were hitting for hypertension, but the proper guideline targets, you're quite right, we weren't doing anywhere near as well. I think it's about 70%, which means 30% of people were not having their blood pressure adequately controlled. So I'm arguing more around the process and the intermediate outcome measures. But you see, and again, I don't want this just to be about COF, but on the other hand, I thought what I think we should do with it is we should do what the VA did in the States, the Veterans Association did in the States, where they have tightly linked measures, where what they would do is they would say, if someone's blood pressure isn't well controlled, you then put in a measure that says that something was done in response to that poorly controlled blood pressure. So maybe medication was increased, or you know, more lifestyle advice. So you have to do something in response to too high a blood pressure, and you pay for the action of improvement. So I think there's so many other ways that we could think imaginatively about this, not just keep throwing money at it.
Well, I agree with the therapeutic inertia. I mean, you definitely see it in secondary care, and you see it especially with the juniors and the hypertension and diabetes clinics that I work in, that you know, you'll find that blood pressure is actually not even adequately checked, because you tend to see the terminal digit bias of 140 over 90, 150 over 90.
Yeah.
The chance of that is 1 in 16, so you just know that the blood pressure hasn't been checked correctly to start with. And that you'll find that quite often it will just be below a threshold, and then when you come along and check it, it's nowhere near that threshold. Mm-hmm. There's a therapeutic inertia that they don't want to increase the number of times.
Could I widen this a little more? Because some years, albeit around the COF as well a little, I'm sorry, but it's an interesting innovation over the last several years. Indeed, several years ago, you were, you weren't, I'm sure, told to produce an editorial, but you were involved in an editorial around hypertension, which I will leave because...
to Mark's work about health inequalities.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I would like to take it a little further, because it's more than just diseases. Doctors are at least GPs, and I hope other doctors too, may I say, are interested in the whole person. And that other paper, which you would know better than me, I'm sure, was able to demonstrate that, in part at least, we were able to do things that probably people thought was impossible. And now that to me is a real effort, because in a sense hypertension, we have problems with hypertension. I mean, Professor Rothwell in several sessions in the Lancet this last year begins to make us really challenge how we look about hypertension. Let's look about the socioeconomic issues. Would you like to care to comment on those?
I have to say, part of the reason why I got involved with POC in 2005 is that I've always worked in, I'm going to answer your question with you, Rose. I've always worked in very deprived parts of Birmingham in the inner city, and I have observed poor care. It makes me sound like I'm sort of a paragon of virtue, but I frankly observed really poor care. And I always thought I always hoped COF would actually bring the tail of the comet up, and that's why I got involved. And you know, people would say to me, oh, Helen, the trouble is us marvellous people, you know, we're being stymied in our wonderful holistic care. You know, and I'm saying, look, you know, you're clever enough to do both. You know, really, frankly, you're telling me that you can't tick a box and look at a patient, so, you know, I was having none of that. It's about the tail of the comet that you move on. And I do genuinely believe COF has done that, and it's not just the sort of, you know, 8-8, I believe. There is Mark's Ashworth's lovely paper in the BMJ about hypertension. There's Tim Doran's paper in the Lancet in 2008, where he looked at the effect of COF on
pretty much every practice, and he divided every practice in the land into deprivation quintiles, and he showed that over a 3-year period, the gap between the best, the least deprived and the most deprived narrowed from 4.4 to 0.8%. And that made QOF technically an equitable intervention, which is really rare. So I do think QOF has done some good, or I wouldn't still be involved with it. I think it has moved the tail of the comet on. But I think we're now at the Thomas Lawson stage. You know, you don't keep bunny masks up.
Other questions?
Yes, Professor Harden.
I'm going to call you Dr. Lester because I don't know you. When I know you well, I shall call you Helen. my question really is, I'm a little concerned about your hope that there will be a 5-year training for general practice. When we qualified in the old, bad old days, we were told that the aim of the medical school in Belfast was to create a safe doctor. And we had 5, indeed we had 6 years in my time. And we thought we were pretty well trained at that stage, and many of us were happy and went out into family practice. But of course there is great need for further expertise in this. So I'm just concerned if the message goes out that if you want to be to practice general practice, primary care in the future, that you've got to do 5 years at the medical school and then another 5 years. I don't really think that's what you're saying. You're saying that there should be 5 years as a trainee, if you like. But that's not really the same as saying that you're not doing general practice, that you can't do it until you've done 5 years extra.
What I'm saying is that actually you've got your F1 and your F2s, and then at the moment you then have 3 years where some of that will be spent in primary care as your trainee, and obviously 2 years would be spent in hospital still. What the college is saying, and I agree with this, I absolutely agree with this, is that 3 years should be 5 years, of which a lot of that, maybe 4 years of it, would be doing hospital-based specialities. And
that's an impossibility.
Wow.
You cannot do all the specialties
for
a long enough time, because the time you've done specialty 6, specialty 1 will have changed and its guidelines will be totally different. So you have to live with it as it develops, surely.
I get that point, but I still have a very good... I remember arguing my fellow SHOs that we should move on every 3 months after in our SHO jobs, because I remember that... I must remember as well, that tremendous feeling in the first 6 weeks that your learning curve was vertical and it was fantastic, and all this new information and new things and new knowledge and new technical things that you were taught. And I used to feel by 3 months I'd probably sussed it. I was very arrogant, but I was young. But there was this sort of... And I do think that having that exposure to more secondary care, so that you get OBS and GAN, EMPs and CASH, and mental health, and perhaps some more general medicine, and care of the elderly. I think to have that ability to suck all that information in at a young age, and then to take that into primary care, and of course then to keep updated, because you're right, we're out of date so quickly. I do think that that's a good thing. I mean, I'm sorry for bad arguing, but if you like, take it as a personal opinion. I think the more that we can equip the younger graduates with extra knowledge, I'm hopeful, and extra skills, I'm hopeful they will be better general practitioners.
Okay. So we're going to break up the fight for a minute and keep it on the right wing. Colin.
What Professor Haddon said was, following on from that, is that if we were going to move to 5 years, I take his point that it would be very difficult to have people in hospital for that length of time. And one of the things that I'm noticing now, people coming out who are the younger doctors doing lots of training in hospital, but they don't get enough general practice training to deal with the non-disease that they see in general practice, and they become frustrated in the job because they've got so, if you like, high-powered in their training, they're coming out wanting to see disease, and they're not comfortable seeing non-disease. And so if there is going to be 5 years training, has to be paediatrics and general practice, not serious paediatrics as in hospital. It has to be diabetes in general practice, not what Professor Haddon did in the Royal and Hospital Diabetics. So,
I'm with you 100%. Another story. When I finished my teaching training, I hadn't done any mental health training at all, but I'd done my year as a trainee, and I knew that I needed to go and do some psychiatry before I would allow myself to apply for a partnership. I had a blazing now. Then I, do you know, there's this sort of callousness, or patients just don't care when you're young. I went to see the professor of psychiatry in Cardiff, who was a sort of high-flying geneticist. And I said, I need to do some mental health training, but I don't need to work with you. I don't want to go work in the psychogeriatric ward either. I need to go work in I think we have CMHTs in those days, but I want to go work in the community. I want to work with the CPNs. I want to know about sort of people that I would have referred in that I shouldn't refer in. I want to learn what I should do in primary care. Actually, I think mainly because he was scared of me, he let me do that. So I had a year in the community. On a sort of made-up job for me that allowed me to go and do exactly what you're saying, which is to have relevant training for primary care. So I think that's the trick, that we can't just have like the paediatrics being 6 months on Skidoo, because that's going to get us nowhere. So I absolutely agree with you. And that needs to be written in.
I hope the Professor of Psychiatry realised you were demonstrating wonderful insight by your comments.
I thought I was stopping
them. Any other questions? So the gentleman here, you had your hand up.
Oh, I was just going to say that I qualified as a GP 2 years ago. I've said it was 5 years, run through training from the F2. I wouldn't apply. I think that 12 years as being locked into a system where you have relatively little sort of freedom to make, you know, to shape it yourself, is a lot.
What
I'm enjoying doing as much as possible is going back in hospital at times. I do a little bit of locum work in emergency and medicine. I wish that there was more in other specialties. If I could usefully spend a month here, a month there, that would be, I'd really enjoy that. Because having now done some general practice, I kind of know what I want to learn, whereas when you're running through, before you've done general practice, you don't even know what's going to be useful to you. But I don't see much opportunity in that way.
I think that's a really good point. I think that's also about the timing of when you do your general practice, about maybe at the beginning, so that you just say, I didn't realise until I finished all of my supposed training that I had a huge hole in what I needed to know. I had to go and find it myself. But I think what you're saying is absolutely right. If you have some primary care, some general practice at the beginning, then you can know what you need to know, sort of on a Rumsfeld way. But I'm going to differ over 5 years. And there we go.
Very interesting point. Any other questions?
Just by way of a comment, there's very little under the sun that doesn't that changes in some ways. One of the phrases that colleagues of me, and I am extremely old now in these terms, was coming up for air. That's what people, when we started in our first cohort of people actually having training for general practice, which most people thought we were out of our tree, but amongst us was the phrase coming up for air. And when I think of what you've said today, you come up for air at various points, and that's when you need to be ready, and we need to have enough wit to realize, to utilize that appropriately. I know it's quite a challenge, but it's actually very important.
Time for one more.
Just another comment. 3 years ago, our practice manager took all her secretaries of the practice into a room and said, "Hands up, who wants to be a phlebotomist?" And I thought this was a little bit of lateral thinking, because she had heard from the nurses that they were overworked and had too many bloods to take, especially at 8:30 in the morning for fasting sugars and lipids and so on. So I thought that was just a little bit of lateral thinking and innovation.
Mm. Absolutely. Everyday innovations. Mm. I think.
And I was surprised. Two hands went up.
That's a good story.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, we've heard a little bit tonight about evidence-based medicine and right from Sackett onwards. And I suppose if we were going to test the theory tonight, we might want to look at Ernest Boyer's definitions of scholarship. I noted down discovery, integration, application, and teaching. And I think, Helen, tonight you've been a wonderful example of that. So I offer you the evidence. And I'm sure, along with me, you would want to once again thank Professor Helen Lester for a very thoughtful presentation.